Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Versa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF.net out of Santa Rosa, California. The Final Straw is brought to you by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Karma Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm features organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found online at www.firestormcafe.com. We're speaking with Dawn Paley, an independent journalist from Vancouver, BC. Ms. Paley has been covering the intersections of militarization of Latin American nation-states and the U.S. military intervention in those nations under the guise of the war on drugs. These recent articles and audio documentaries that Dawn Paley produced point to alternative motives on the part of the U.S. and these other governments. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the title of one of your pieces on narco-trafficking groups and the expansion of neoliberal capitalism is entitled Drug War Capitalism. Can you define drug war capitalism?
It's a term that I invented to, you know, sort of in the spirit of Naomi Klein's work, where she talks about disaster capitalism. So I use drug war capitalism to talk about or to start looking at the drug war as a vehicle through which capitalist policies, investments, you know, and then the raw materials needed to keep the whole machine not only humming but expanding. The drug war is a vehicle for that to become reality. It's a new repressive module or technique through which, you know, territory is cleared, as we talked about, or as we will talk about, and through which, you know, workers can be kept down. Also something that, you know, isn't really talked about, I'm doing a little bit of work on this now and I hope to publish something soon, is that, like, when they do things like Plan Colombia and Plan Mexico, there's also, like, a social slash economic component. In Colombia, they reformed, like, 52 pieces of legislation and regulation linked to the financial sector. And in Mexico, there's similar changes happening, like on a legal level, which I consider to be like a deepening of NAFTA, but always connected to the idea of the war on drugs. So the way they sell it is like, well, we need to open up the economy and we need to have a stronger economy and more investment because that will give people more opportunities and they won't go into drugs. That's the sort of discursive strategy. And then what they're actually doing is they're continuing to deepen the neoliberal program in Mexico. So it's multi-layered, and drug war capitalism tries to capture that and say the drug war is not about cocaine. It's not about marijuana. Those are symptoms, maybe you could call them. But the actual key thrust of U.S. policy in Mexico is the expanding the capitalist system and creating better conditions for foreign direct investment, especially from U.S. corporations, but from many other large corporations as well.
Most Americans experience the war on drugs as a militarization of police, harsh minimum sentencing laws in the United States, a huge upsurge in imprisonment and disenfranchisement of populations of the poor and disproportionately of people of color for nonviolent offenses. Can you talk about the other side of the war on drugs that people living in the United States don't necessarily experience on this side of the border?
Sure. I mean, the war on drugs started, I think, in 1971 with Richard Nixon. And I just saw an excellent film that I'd recommend as well to your listeners. It's called The House I Live In. And it's a documentary that does a really fantastic job of talking about the war on drugs in the United States. But, you know, it's kind of course, there was a precedent. Before the war on drugs started, there was already the criminalization of different communities within the United States, communities, particularly communities of color, like Mexican community, Chinese migrant laborers were criminalized by linking them to opium, and et cetera. Going back before the war on drugs started, But also outside of the U.S., like before that term was invented or coined, there were, you know, opium and illegal drugs, you know, within quotation marks, illegal drugs, were already a pretext for different invasions that took place in Asia involving imperial powers. And so it's like slowly morphed over time. And certainly that, you know, it's good to look back and that date comes up a lot, you know, when Richard Nixon first coined the term war on drugs. And since then it's gone on and it's morphed and it's changed a lot. And it kind of had a Star Wars phase with the Reagan years, which were extremely intense inside the United States. But also when, you know, the war on drugs started to become this way of the U.S. really projecting a very particular and intense kind of power in other states. And what I've been looking at on my work in particular, because I am focused on Latin America and do a lot of work in Mexico and elsewhere, is the year 2000. I mean, through the 1990s, it became clear that the U.S. was using the war on drugs to start to intervene in the political system in Colombia. But the year 2000 is like sort of the watershed where a lot of my work starts from, and a lot of people who are looking at Mexico right now go back to the year 2000 because that's when the U.S. and Colombia started something called Plan Colombia. And Plan Colombia was a six-year plan, and it was based around basically the militarization of the war on drugs. So actually, you know, beefing up armies, training police, using military tactics, hiring way more police, getting, you know, these equipment donations and stuff from the United States, like helicopters and special, you know, screening equipment and so on into Colombia. There was other parts of Plan Colombia as well that included, you know, they were doing crop eradication, so they would fly over, you know, peasant communities and dump a bunch of toxic chemicals on their fields, claiming that, you know, that's how they were going to eliminate cocaine. And of course, this wasn't just happening in Colombia. There was other programs in Bolivia and Peru that were extremely controversial, as well as in Mexico. But really, Plan Colombia was something new. It was like an important evolution of U.S., you know, foreign policy as linked to narcotics. And Plan Colombia supposedly was written by Colombia and the United States, although Noam Chomsky, you know, he wrote in one of his books that he had information that the first draft of Plan Colombia was actually written in English. And so Plan Colombia lasted from 2000 to 2006. And then the next year, in 2007, the U.S. and Mexico launched something called the Merida Initiative. But critics and even some supporters called the Merida Initiative Plan Mexico. It was very similar to Plan Colombia. Since then, in 2008, the U.S. launched the Central America Regional Security Initiative, which is basically like Plan Central America. And then just recently, in 2010... they began something called the Caribbean Basin Regional Security Initiative, which is, again, like Plan Caribbean. So the reason that the year 2000 and what's happened since Plan Colombia is so important because Plan Colombia provided a kind of template which the U.S. has continued to use as a way of intervening militarily and, you know, politically in different countries in the hemisphere.
So Plan Colombia began in 2000, and at the time, a good third of Colombia was controlled by an armed leftist group called the FARC that's been identified as being a narco-trafficking organization and controlling a good amount of territory. Can you talk a bit about non-governmental or paramilitary effects of Plan Colombia within Colombia, I guess?
Colombia is an extremely complicated country because of how long the internal guerrilla movements had been going on for. And there was more than one. There was as well as the FARC, there was, there was other guerrilla organizations active in the country. But what we saw with the militarization Colombia has been paramilitarized for a very long time, which means there was different waves of paramilitarization that took place, but throughout the 90s, it was very common for like local elites and large landowners and so on to hire, you know, their own armed forces and create their own armed forces to protect their property and so on, supposedly. But these paramilitary groups were actually, you know, the groups that in the long run ended up being responsible for the majority of things like massacres of peasants, killings, you know, disappearances and so on. And these paramilitary groups were known to have been two things. One, working hand in hand with the Colombian army, so actually joint patrolling, working really closely together. Two, the paramilitary groups, the paramilitary leaders were also becoming rich. And this has to do with, you know, charging extortion, also in some cases connection to, you know, narco activity and narco trafficking. The paramilitary leaders were found to have been funding political parties and particular politicians. So you have, you know, you had a state in Colombia, and this is all through the 90s and through the 2000s, that was basically, you know, being controlled in large part by these illegal armed groups who were often killing poor people, indigenous people, civilians, etc. And the U.S., regardless of that, decided that their cooperation, you know, Colombia was their number one ally in South America. They were working hand in hand, the U.S., and the U.S. was always holding up Alvaro Uribe, the former president, as, you know, a beacon of democracy and security. And so this is part of sort of, you know, why U.S. involvement in Colombia. I mean, the situation in Colombia was already problematic, and for the U.S. to go in and then, you know, fund the army, they, you know, Colombia just went right up to the top. I believe since 2000, the U.S. has spent $8 billion in Colombia, and the majority of that is military, right? So they're arming this army that's working with paramilitary forces to do things like extrajudicial assassinations of political opponents, etc., etc. Another phenomenon that we saw is that the paramilitary groups in Colombia were also carrying out repression that against working people, for example, against trade unionists, that actually ended up favoring multinational corporations. And there's been a couple of court cases in the U.S., one involving Chiquita Banana, and another one, I think it's BP, I'm not sure the second one. I don't have it right in front of me, but definitely with Chiquita Banana, the paramilitary groups were actually, you know, taking payments from the U.S. banana company to repress workers, to prevent them from organizing, prevent them from demanding, you know, their rights as workers and a fair salary and so on. So you started to see that collusion between, you know, not just large landowners and the elite class of Colombia and the paramilitary groups, but also between U.S. And other multinational corporations. BP also settled out of court because of payments to paramilitary groups that resulted in people being murdered. So you had this paramilitarization that was favoring that sector, right? The business sector, the large business sector in Colombia. You know, that's, I guess, and that's just like one angle of it. I mean, you still have in many territories, and I'm not sure how much territory the FARC was, you know, quote unquote controlling, or their zone of influence, how large it was in 2000. And people have probably heard that recently there was, you know, peace negotiations. It seemed pretty tattered. There's been, you know, a few hostages released and maybe a little bit of progress, but there still is an active insurgency, although, you know, it's certainly smaller than it used to be. But again, I'd like to focus on the fact that if you look at the offenses and if you look at the people who've been disappeared and displaced, I mean, Colombia has over 4 million people who've been displaced from their land, who've been forced to flee because of violence. The vast majority of those offenses against people, that aggression, that repression, has come from the state and from paramilitary forces. So we have this focus in the media of course, on, you know, the leftist insurgency and the supposedly the Marxist guerrillas and so on, you know, as the problem, when in fact we see that it's the right wing and the state forces that are responsible for a lot of the tragedy that is, you know, especially rural Colombia and parts of some Colombian cities. And just keep in mind that the U.S. government has supported lock and step those groups. One more thing, Colombia claims that they've demobilized the paramilitary groups, but it's not true. That's simply a lie. I mean, there has been processes where paramilitaries have been able to trade their weapons and go to some kind of alternative training. But at the same time, like, when you're on email lists or in touch with people in Colombia, it's clear that those groups still exist. They just have different names today, those paramilitary groups.
So the disruption of social struggles around workplace democracy or around like legal, around the ability to organize unions is one disruption that the paramilitaries have been responsible in apparently in collusion with the governments there, as well as indirectly, at least because of U.S. funding and militarization with the U.S. government has claimed some or has some responsibility.
Absolutely.
There's another aspect of it that's the widespread displacement, the massacres you mentioned of indigenous people, and the widespread displacement of populations. How does that fit into the realm of the landowners and their hired paramilitaries? And then also, does that benefit the multinational corporations that are being brought in through these development programs?
Right. Well, I have a great quote from two researchers from Kent University in England, David Mayer and Andrew Thompson. So I'll just read briefly. They describe this phenomenon as, and I quote, paramilitary forces continue to advance a process of capital accumulation through the forced displacement of communities in areas of economic importance. Large sections of Colombia's citizenry continue to abandon their lands as they are forcibly displaced from their homes, satisfying the voracious appetite of foreign, and this is mainly U.S., multinational corporations for Colombian territory as a neoliberal economic program is further entrenched in Colombian society. So, for example, I know when I was in Colombia, there was starting to be, in the south, a lot of new mining concessions for gold mining. And, you know, researchers in Colombia and people who are looking at this are going, well, you know, there's all this gold and they're in places where there used to be communities. 10 years ago, there was a community there. Now it's empty. And the mining company's coming in and they're going, well, it wasn't us. I mean, that happened way before we got here, right? So they have this plausible deniability. The companies do. But, you know, there's this trend. Like, I remember once when I was in Colombia, we were watching the news and it was showing people who were returning back to their lands after like 8 years of having been displaced. And they left because there was just like, you know, gunfire and they were being threatened. And like, if you there's a great video, a great documentary called Impunity that shows this really well. You know, the paramilitaries would call all of the civilians, all of the citizens of a small town, tiny little village, to all come into the central square, and they execute people in front of them, and they threaten them, and they say, you know, you're ours now. You have to obey us. And so, of course, people flee there in fear. And so these people were coming back to their land after like 8 years, and it was all planted with palm oil. And I mean, you could see it on the newsreel, and it was just like, wait a second. So they left their town, and it's not like their town was just abandoned. It was actually actively planted with palm, and the palm was being harvested by the time they went back by, you know, large landowners, or in the case of palm oil, it's more like Colombian corporations. But in the case of like mining and so on, you have a lot of corporate interests who benefit from that displacement.
It seems like without lawsuits and without, or the leaking of internal documents, though, that sort of thing would, the sort of connection would be tangential or difficult to actually prove. Is that right?
Well, I mean, I think it in a way, but I think at the same time, and especially for people who enjoy listening to radio, I mean, maybe it's also opens a conversation about our bias towards text. So, for example, when you go into those communities, people will tell you that stuff. or the people who've been displaced. I mean, there's like no shortage of people who can orally tell you, you know, in detail, and then you go, wait, this isn't just one community. Like, this is like a dozen places this is happening. This is like two dozen places this is happening. So it's certainly not necessarily easy. I think, you know, there's that sort of, that like seeking, like, how do you say it? Like some kind of lurking, like conspiracy theory sort of accusation that could sort of, that you could feel like, yeah, you know, maybe this is just a, you know, maybe this is a wild theory and maybe it's just a coincidence. But I'm convinced, like, and because of having done the research and like looking at these court cases and, you know, and internal documents and so on, that it's not a coincidence. It's not that, you know, the U.S. government is somehow controlling every single thing and knows every single resource deposit. But at the same time, you just can look at these trends and to say it's not happening in one community. It's happening systematically. This is actually something that is being enforced and being allowed by the state. You know, like, impunity is a huge word in Latin America. It's, you know, one of the main things that in every country that I've worked in, that, you know, people, when they try to explain why things are the way they are, why there's so much violence in their communities or in their countries, it's like, it's impunity. It's because people who perpetrate, they get away with it. And impunity is created by the state and maintained by the state, right? And in this case, in the case of Colombia and many other countries, the impunity of whatever state it is also enforced or sort of backed up by the United States, right? They shake hands with them and they give them, you know, recognition and hold them up as human rights defenders, even though they're, you know, responsible directly or indirectly for killing, you know, their own population. So, you know, the impunity is, it's sort of one of the key, I think, the key factors to understanding all of this and thinking of impunity not just as something that just happens, but as something that's created and maintained.
There's a connection in a lot of these places that you've studied between the official, like between the military and the paramilitary mm-hmm. organizations. Like, it's well documented that the Zetas rose out of a parachute division mm-hmm. of the Federales yeah. or the Mexican military?
They're an elite. The Federales are militarized police, and so the Zetas, which are, you know, an illegal armed group in Mexico, or some people call them a cartel. The Zetas came out of an elite Air Force unit.
And then there's also in Guatemala, you write about the Cabiles.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk about them for a sec?
Sure. I mean, it's really, so of course you can look at Plan Colombia and Plan Mexico and Plan, you know, Central America and Plan Caribbean and go, wow, there's like a lot of similarities or there's a lot of the same thing going on. But of course, every context is extremely different, right? So the paramilitarization of Mexican society exists, and it existed before the drug war started, but not in the same way or to the same level as it did in Colombia. And what is really striking about Mexico is the level to which the organized crime groups or the cartels or the criminal organizations or whatever you'd like to call them, how many former, like, ex-military and sometimes even active duty military and police officers you have working in these criminal organizations. So you gave the example of the Zetas, which came out of an elite Air Force unit. And that Air Force unit, interestingly, was one of the last units to receive group training in the United States. So the whole group would go to the United States, they call them GAFES. And then they would get training and they would come back and serve in Mexico. Now, the U.S., of course, denies that they've trained any Zetas, although they admit to possibly of training one. But, you know, just pointing out that I think there's more. I mean, it's well documented, a lot of this stuff, but you know, like, there's still a lot more work that could be done, I think, to excavate more information. The Cabiles were an elite unit of the Guatemalan army. They were responsible for some of the most horrific massacres that happened during that country's 36-year internal armed conflict. You know, I was just reading today about the massacre of Dos Eres, where, you know, over 200 people were murdered by Cabiles, and just, you know, with hammers, right? Like, in just the most sort of atrocious things. So many Caiviles have been documented to have gone and started working with different cartels in Mexico, including Los Zetas. And according to someone I talked to who runs a research center in Guatemala City, she told me that, you know, it's to the extent where some of the time they'll catch, you know, these supposed Zetas, and they'll turn out to be active duty Caiviles. So they actually are still, you know, it's like, well, why aren't they noticing that they're not in their regiments or whatever, or doing what they're supposed to be doing? They're actually serving with the Zetas. And then, you know, all along the border, the north border, the U.S.-Mexico border, you have a long tradition of, you know, what we call a drug cartel, often being formed in part or in whole by, you know, current and former police officers. So there's that sort of bleed between, and then you have, you know, high level generals and chiefs of police and so on, who every so often one of them has to suddenly retire because it's, wow, it turns out this guy's taking, you know, huge payments from these organized crime groups and so on. So there's a lot of connections between official repressive forces and these supposed, you know, separate criminal groups.
When someone is found to have been a Cabile or a former, like, Federale who's involved in these events, these activities of displacing indigenous populations, do they face criminal charges, or are they usually enveloped in impunity themselves?
You know, there's a lot of things going on, so I think you probably get everything from your first sort of suggestion to your last. Like, sometimes they'll get away with it for their whole lives, and other times, you know, if someone does get caught, they might want to do a show trial and make a big deal and say, you know, we got this guy and we're going to punish him. Mexico fairly recently passed new legislation that promises extremely harsh penalties for people who defect from the army and go into criminal organizations. I haven't done the research, though, to be able to tell you how effective or how many prosecutions there's been under that new law. I mean, another thing, just to bring it up, because it's very topical right now, is Rios Montt, who was, the president of Guatemala in 1982, 1983, and who was president during the beginning of the scorched earth policy, where, you know, the army the army generally would go in and just massacre entire communities and burn them. Rios Montt is actually going to trial for genocide now. So, you know, 30 years later, he's in his 80s now, but he's finally being brought to trial in Guatemala. So, you know, it's kind of symbolic, but it's very important as well. So, you know, you do have efforts, at least on some level, to, and there's always people, you know, activists and people fighting for justice who are pushing for criminals and especially, you know, people with protection. Like Rios Montt, he was a congressman for years and years and years. So he actually had formal impunity, like legal, like he couldn't be tried. Immunity, that's what they call it, right? So he, you know, he's being tried right now. And that, so there's kind of everything, you know, and at the same time as Rios Montt is now going to be tried for genocide, the current president of Guatemala, Otto Pérez Molina, who was head of intelligence during that time, in the early 80s, during the worst years of the war there, is, you know, he's the president. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot of different blacks and whites making up a very complex gray. But I would say overall, impunity is the rule and not the exception.
We'll be right back with our conversation with Don Paley, independent journalist out of Vancouver, BC, and also at times out of Mexico, about drug war capitalism. To read more by Dawn Paley or hear some of her audio reports, check out her website at dawnpaley.ca. That's dawnpaley.ca. We'll be right back. with our conversation with Don Paley about drug war capitalism in Latin America. So the U.S. profits by pushing through these plans to liberalize economies in Latin America and in other portions of the world, but since we're focusing on Latin America, and a lot of these corporations end up paying, like, A, they produce jobs within the United States. They produce oftentimes lower cost products, whether it be something based on the nickel that's mined out of Guatemala or something that's based off of the copper that was mined out of Chile, or, you know, or the bananas coming into the country or what have you, or the maquiladoras, like cheaper consumer goods for the U.S. population. These politicians end up getting funding for their campaigns from a lot of these multinational corporations. But what benefits come to the U.S. military for working hand in hand with these organizations?
Which organizations?
Well, with the nations, like to militarize the policing agencies and to make them more robust, make the militaries more robust in the name of stopping narco trafficking.
Right now, from the latest information that I have, SOUTHCOM, which is the Southern Command, which is responsible for U.S. military presence from Belize and Guatemala, basically down. So Mexico is under the control of the Northern Command, and the southern part of the hemisphere is under the Southern Command, have about 300 on-duty soldiers or members deployed in South America at all times. So it's pretty small in a way compared to, for example, you know, Middle East or other countries where the U.S. is actively occupying, in Afghanistan, etc. But it's certainly, you know, it's a steady stream of income. It's an argument that they can make. You know, we have to have this active military. We have to have, you know, another thing is that there's constantly U.S. warships going up and down the coasts from the States down to, you know, Latin America and back. And I was just reading a document recently that was put out in November 2012 by the United States House Committee on Homeland Security. And they are basically, in this report, they're trying to argue that what they call terrorist organizations have managed to infiltrate the drug cartels. And so what they're attempting to do is sort of start turning on the tap to start saying, well, actually, they're not just drug cartels, they're terrorists. And I'm noticing more slippage. So reading articles in the mainstream media where they kind of talk about narco-terrorists or terrorist activity and organized crime, like as if it's all the same thing. And I think that is sort of building towards being able to justify even greater, you know, military budgets, military spending, and so on in Latin America and in Mexico. I will say, though, that definitely some of the beneficiaries are, you know, the private contractors. I mean, when you look at the Merida Initiative, I wish I had this in front of me. I'll try to pull up a document here while we're chatting. But if you look at what was actually delivered and what the money was spent on, that the U.S. government spent on the Merida Initiative, in large part, it's buying equipment from U.S. defense contractors, so including Bell helicopters and Black Hawk helicopters and et cetera. They are, you know, obviously among the very important direct beneficiaries of this kind of militarization, those types of companies.
You brought up in your recent audio documentary on Guatemala, let's see, you talked to Claudia Samoyoa, about the introduction of U.S. combat troops into Guatemala. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It was a very, sort of quiet, like a mission. It came out in the U.S. press in August of 2012 that the U.S. had deployed 200 U.S. Marines, and those Marines would be serving in Guatemala. I went down to Guatemala because that was really all the information we had. I managed to get the agreements that were you know, signed between the U.S. Embassy and the government of Guatemala, the executive. And, you know, those agreements, the content is shocking, allowing, you know, U.S. troops and defense contractors, private defense contractors, to go in and out of the country with no checks whatsoever, to bring whatever equipment they need in and out of the country, to fly in and out of the country with no, like, they wouldn't ever have to go through Guatemalan customs or even the most cursory kind of check. And also, of course, guarantees them impunity in the case of, for example, if they were to murder a civilian or otherwise, they would supposedly be tried in the U.S. for that, but that they could not be subject to any kind of you know, justice in Guatemala, as it were. So pretty shocking, that agreement. And, you know, it was about 3 months, I think, or 4 months, the deployment officially. But, you know, doing reading and talking to a lot of people down there, it's clear that especially in some of the areas in the center of the country, there's almost a permanent presence of U.S. military. Some people mentioned to me, you know, like that they suspect that there's, you know, clandestine activities going on, like military bases that are like secret and so on. I wasn't able to verify any of that information, but certainly the deployment of actual U.S. armed troops to fight a drug cartel, the sort of reason that they were going there was supposedly to fight the Zetas drug cartel. So they're actually fighting an international drug cartel, right? Because the Zetas is supposedly are Mexican. I mean, they're a Mexican group. So so having U.S. Marines there flying all over Guatemala, accessing ports, accessing various airports and landing strips and so on, is a huge escalation of U.S. military activity in this part of the world. It followed, of course, a big scandal in Honduras in May when DEA agents, together with Honduran police, were responsible for a massacre of indigenous people who were traveling in a boat in the Mosquitia region. And after that massacre took place, you know, the U.S. embassy and the DEA and so on initially tried to deny that it had been their responsibility or that it had anything to do with them, but very difficult since they were using State Department helicopters. And so the U.S. actually basically canned or canceled that part of its sort of deployment, drug war deployment in Honduras. And just, you know, a few months later showed up 200 U.S. Marines in Guatemala in a big escalation. I will say that you didn't, I mean, being in Guatemala City or being in some of the regions, it's not like you'd see necessarily U.S. troops walking down the street or something like that. Like, it's still a relatively small deployment. But, you know, unfortunately, I think it's the first of what could become more and more. You know, I'm a big fan of the work of Greg Grandin, who I quoted in the piece I did for Towards Freedom on Guatemala. And he has an excellent book called Empire's Workshop, where he talks about how when, you know, there was the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam and from parts of Asia, that it was then followed by an intensification of U.S. military activity, although obviously not like a draft and sending tons and tons of soldiers, but a huge intensification of U.S. military presence in this hemisphere, particularly in Central America in the 1980s. And, you know, it can be argued that there's been a shift since back towards the Middle East and so on. And I think right now we're unfortunately at the beginning of a remilitarization of Latin America, as, you know, some of the deployments in the Middle East start to wind down even slightly, freeing up manpower and resources for, you know, increased U.S. presence here in Latin America, military presence. And, you know, the one piece that we haven't really talked about, but, you know, Latin America is extremely strategic resource-wise. And there's tons of minerals, there's oil, there's gas, there's forests, there's dams, there's electricity. I mean, you can dam a river in Honduras and get the electricity in Missouri, something that simply, like, it doesn't work like that, right, in other parts of the world. So There's all kinds of reasons that I argue may have more to do with U.S. policy, like may have more to do with controlling some of those resources and accessing those resources than it does to do with stopping drugs. Also, like, the flow of drugs is really not reduced. U.S. government studies show that over Plan Colombia, the amount of cocaine arriving to the United States actually increased. So if it was about drugs, it's a failure. And that brings, you know, the question, why would they be applying a failed policy? And that's where I think it's necessary for us to start thinking outside of the box about what the war on drugs means in Latin America and elsewhere too.
Other than your work, obviously, what kind of work are non-Spanish speaking North Americans doing that can be helpful to break the impunity in Latin America, to extend solidarity down to people living in Honduras and Guatemala and Mexico and Belize and Colombia?
Yeah, that's like a really huge question, right? And there's so many angles. I mean, obviously stuff like your listeners are aware of, like just tuning into independent media, alternative media, seeking out different voices. There's amazing, you know, books, like I mentioned, Greg Grandin's work is really fantastic, but there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of really interesting writing and analysis about what's happening. I write often for a website called Upside Down World. It's a really good source of information from a sort of more critical or more grassroots perspective on what's happening in Latin America, and that's in English. And I guess, you know, I've always felt that the other piece is just that in terms of, you know, solidarity, and solidarity is very important, and it's important to have people's memory and people's struggles and so on, but also just being in our own struggles. For example, however we decide that, you know, we're going to organize against, you know, what we see as wrong and oppressive and repressive in our own communities, is something that, you know, our struggles are all connected. So even though you might be working on, you know, the Walmart unionization or another kind of organizing in your community, I think that even any kind of struggle is really in solidarity with other people's struggles. And then just, you know, having, like, just being able to have a conversation with people, like, a lot of people, you know, so I think about it a lot, and I think the war on drugs is a very complicated, it's hard to sort of talk about, like, it gets into, like, people's morality and ethics, and so I think, you know, one thing is just to try to, you know, consider and try to create your own position on, like, okay, what does the war on drugs mean? It means, like, a lot of civilians are being murdered, right? It means that the police are being militarized. It means that the U.S. is spending billions of dollars sending weapons down to Latin America, etc. Okay, you know, maybe I don't have a position, or you don't necessarily want to take a public position on, like, whether or not you agree with cocaine or whatever, but take the drugs out of it for a second and just look at what's happening in these societies. And, like, I think that's the important thing, is not to be blinded by, you know, this boogeyman of the bad drugs or whatever that sort of distorts our ability to have a conversation about the militarization and about the economic, you know, changes that take place alongside the implementation of things like Plan Colombia and Plan Mexico and so on. So just kind of like taking some deep breaths and going, okay, I'm not going to go into this whole drug thing. I'm just going to look at the other stuff. And I think just creating a little bit more awareness about that kind of stuff is really crucial in terms of being able to just have that conversation with your neighbor or with your father or with your brother or, you know, with your friend. And I think that's one way that we can also, you know, be in solidarity with people down here.
Were there any other things that you wanted to address that maybe I didn't lead into or you didn't have a chance to address so far?
Well, I mentioned at the beginning this film that I just saw. It's called The House I Live In, and I would totally recommend it. I mean, they have some amazing footage. They show this black and white footage of, you know, it's like a PSA or whatever from, like, I can't remember what year, but it's like a guy who's, they're filming him, and supposedly he's, like, killing his mother because he's high on marijuana. And it's
Reefer
like this
madness,
whole,
possibly.
Yeah, like, I don't know what it was from. It might have been from that, but it's like, you know, creating this whole panic, like, if you smoke marijuana, you're going to go crazy and, like, start killing people with an axe and stuff. And then they show this footage, like, you know, from, like, 40 years later or whatever, and it's the same exact thing. And it's like, you'll kill your mother if you smoke crack. Like, people who smoke crack kill their mothers. And it's just like, wow, you know, like, wow, like, total propaganda, totally targeting, like, certain groups of people as being guilty, as being the bad people because they're using or whatever. But, yeah, just, like, a level of the propaganda around the drug war is so intense. But my only critique of that film was that they didn't really talk about migration or the border or stuff like that. And I felt like, you know, I think that's something we also haven't talked about. So maybe just, like, briefly, I think... and I've written a little bit about this, but like the U.S.-Mexico border, you know, some of the most dangerous cities in Mexico are right on the border. Like Ciudad Juarez is the one that, you know, people will often know about just because of the amount of murders that have taken place in that city over the last, like, specifically over the last 6 years, but more so since 2008. But just thinking about how the border works, and the border is absolutely crucial to the war that the U.S. is helping bring to Mexico. A lot of the militarization happens on the border. A lot of the just, you know, really intense repression. And then, you know, of course you have on the other side, U.S. border agents who are totally corrupt, who are part of the system that is allowing, you know, drug traffickers to move their product into the United States. I mean, yeah, some of them are doing it in desert areas, but other ones just, there is a lot of, like, corruption and so on, also on the U.S. side, but that's not just something in Mexico. So, you know, there's a lot of that, and that's something that makes, you know, what's happening in Mexico kind of different and quite a bit different from what's happening from what has happened also, you know, in Colombia in terms of the militarization of the border and migrants and people needing to flee and claiming refugee status or asylum in the United States because of the violence that they've experienced in Mexico. So I guess that's just another piece of it, right? Like, there's so much anti-migrant hysteria, I would call it, in the United States, but also in Canada and in other countries. And, you know, it's like in Canada, the Canadian government has recently imposed visas on Mexican citizens. But they'll never talk about how there's more violence. Like, there's way more violence in Mexico now than there was 6 years ago. And of course there's going to be refugees. Of course people are going to be seeking asylum. But it just never really, it rarely enters the sort of realm of discussion. So I guess those are just other things to keep in mind as well. It's just, you know, the border and migration and how those things are also connected to the drug war, the war on drugs, which I also think is a war on migrants. Because there's been multiple mass murders of migrants, either Central Americans or Mexicans themselves moving within Mexico who have been, you know, murdered and buried in mass graves or stacked up in the back of a ranch by supposed criminal groups who, again, are often directly in cahoots with local authorities. So it's not just a war on drugs. It's also a war on migrants, and it's never been more dangerous for people to migrate through Mexico from Central America as it is now. It's the whole country is against them in the sense that there's no safe place, you know, for migrants. You know, there's migrant shelters, that's the exception, but the militarization because of the drug war has also created an increasingly militarized environment for people to move around either just freely within their own country or as migrants. Like, you go through checkpoints all the time. So, you know, those are other things I think to keep in mind is just and other ways that it impacts the United States as well.
I'm kind of reminded of, and I know this is talking about a criminal organization, but I'm reminded of a series of stories I remember reading in the Los Angeles Times about 8 or 9 years ago about the foundations of Mara Salvatrucha. Are you familiar with that organization?
A little bit.
MS-13 was basically founded in Los Angeles and in Northern California by Salvadoran youth refugees from the war there, the U.S.-backed war who ended up forming community organizations that ended up becoming, because of the drug trade, poor people who don't have jobs. Oftentimes, if they can't get jobs, will often find other ways of making money, and so drug trade being part of it. But a lot of them ended up being criminalized, partially because of the color of the skin, partially because of the illicit work that they were doing, and eventually became a criminal organization in prisons in the U.S. And starting in the early to mid-1990s, started getting deported en masse down to El Salvador because a lot of them were born there. And so that was a possibility for the U.S. government to be able to get rid of these people. And then MS-13 became a huge criminal organization in the prisons in El Salvador and started running prisons. And now the organization has created a web between El Salvador up north and into the United States, rather than solving the problem by criminalizing and by deporting members of MS-13, they've just exacerbated the problem and created more of an international criminal organization out of it.
I don't know a lot about that case, like the Mara Salvatrucha in particular. I've never really worked in El Salvador. But you can, it's like with this drug war. I mean, since they started, so Felipe Calderon, the former president of Mexico, he just ended his term, declared a war on drugs in December of 2006. And since then, Mexico has seen an unprecedented wave of violence and murders, homicides. Some estimates say that there was up to 120,000 homicides over 6 years, acts of violence that are, absolutely horrid and unthinkable. And, a lot of, when I read about the war on drugs, like when I read about Plan Colombia, when I read about the Merida Initiative, the way I understand it is those are plans to make war in these countries. That's how they make war. They create conflicts. They exacerbate, like you said, these situations that, yes, there needs to be some kind of solution. The solution in this case has been way worse than the problem. Way worse. I mean, we're talking about, again, relatively nonviolent movement of substances as being the problem. And the solution is being 20,000 people being murdered every year. Like, hello, what is the problem here and what is the solution? So it's Orwellian, you know what I mean? Like, it's really becomes so difficult to just take the information at face value. It's just like, okay, they're starting a Plan Caribbean. What does that mean? And if you read the piece I did, which is called Strategies of a Cold War, on Guatemala recently, I talk at the end about how the U.S. government is now, sending their ambassadors and their diplomats and stuff to the Dominican Republic and other places in the Caribbean to say, hey, well, we think this is going to get worse here, this whole drug war thing. And it's like, well, yeah, you guys are going to, like, if you go out and you try to stop people from moving drugs using guns, they're going to shoot back at you, obviously. So, like, they know that. And it's like, okay, the less the U.S. is involved, the better, this is the more peaceful this is going to be. And what's scary is that, for example, like just a few months ago, the New York Times reported that the U.S. government and the Woodrow Wilson Institute, which is essentially an arm of the state, started doing conferences and awareness to say that there's now this major drug problem in West Africa and that they're going to go in there and fight it. And it's like, okay, it's a strategy for intervention. And it's a solution that's far worse than what, the problem is that it's supposedly solving.
And it's a region that the U.S. has been constantly ramping up. They've been ramping up AFRICOM to focus on North Africa and resource extraction and facilitate the security of resource extraction to Western powers since the 1990s. So
it's very, yeah. Unfortunately, it's not going away. Even though you have a sort of a new wave of people discussing legalization, and yeah, there's been these, bills, like I think Colorado and I can't remember where else in the United States, to say, okay, people can have personal consumption or, you know, in Uruguay and different countries, like there's at least like some kind of discussion about legalization as being a possible solution, including Otto Perez Molina, the president of Guatemala, who's, you know, gone out and said, well, we need to look at different solutions. At the same time, he's totally, you know, allowing U.S. troops, DEA, whatever, in his country to go hunt down Guatemala citizens and kill them for supposedly moving drugs. I mean, you know, like it's an important discussion around legalization and so on. But I think, again, we need to focus on like what's happening on the ground, and what's happening on the ground is extreme militarization, increasing militarization, and, you know, a huge push by transnational corporations to get at the resources in all of these countries and in Latin America. And it's just the beginning, right? You know, there's all of Africa, and if the drug war discourse is extremely efficient for people in power, it's very difficult to argue against. Because, you know, of course, if you're against the drug war, you must be in favor of horrible criminals, right? sort of strange dichotomous thinking, but I think it's important for us to start thinking more creatively about what's going on and start looking at other factors and not silo off drugs and the drug war as being about drugs, but actually say, okay, the drug war, and how is this impacting, you know, the oil industry in Colombia, which has boomed since Plan Colombia, or the mining industry in Mexico, et cetera.
Can you say a word about what changes are being proposed or what have gone through with the Mexican legal system? Because I wasn't quite understanding what was meant by the Americanization of the judicial system, like transferring from an oral to a written tradition.
Sure.
Like, written style, is that right?
Mm-hmm. There's a film in Mexico called Presumed Guilty that you could probably get. I think it's on YouTube. And they do a really good job of showing it. Like the Mexican legal system is based on a different legal tradition than the U.S. And so people would, when they went to court, they would have what they call expedientes. They would have the case written up from all different sides of what happened. And the judge would read it and make a ruling based on what he had read. It's a flawed system, and I'm not like saying everything's perfect and peachy keen with the written adversarial system that exists in Mexico. But what the U.S. has done as part of Plan Mexico, which is something that they also did in Colombia, is transform the legal system here so that you have the same kind of courtrooms that you do in the United States. You have jury trials. You have oral trials. So just like they do in the U.S., right? And there are a lot of people who are in favor of reforming, you know, the justice system in Mexico. And for reasons I can understand, you know, people say, well, you can't just change one judge or like one lawyer or whatever. You have to totally change the system. But, you know, there are some red flags there too. And again, that film, I highly recommend it. The House We Live In does a great job of saying, the U.S. is a country in the world that incarcerates the highest percentage of its population. You know, there's more people in jail in the U.S. per capita than anywhere else. And is that the model that Mexico wants and needs, and it's actually going to serve Mexicans and make it more fair? Or is that actually going to result in there being more prisoners? And by all accounts, it looks like that's the case. It looks like, you know, creating and constructing more jails and imprisoning more people in the U.S. model, following the U.S. model, is going to be sort of, unfortunately, you know, increasingly part of government policy. And then there's also, you know, I interviewed a lawyer a couple of years ago here who was talking to me about how those changes in the legal system, so they're changing the legal system state by state, and I think they're supposed to finish by 2016, by which time it's supposedly the U.S., the legal system here is going to work exactly like it does in the U.S., that is also a benefit for transnational corporations, because right now they have to hire Mexican lawyers. But basically he called it like the McDonaldization of the legal system. So like it'll be totally compatible with the U.S. system. And, you know, as long as a lawyer can speak Spanish, if they're a U.S. lawyer, they can come down and work here and represent their company in the court of law and so on. So it's something that I consider very underreported. It's barely talked about in the English media, and I hope to do some more work on it, but it's pretty complicated. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, well, I'm not really in favor of the current system or the proposed system, but I think the important thing is to talk about it. And you know, it would be wonderful if in Mexico it was an initiative that, you know, really did come from like sort of a grassroots movement, and where they said, okay, let's have a series of like roundtables and let's talk about what we want the new justice system to be like. But instead, what's happening is a U.S.-led, U.S.-funded, you know, using U.S. judges, lawyers, law schools, transforming the legal system into a exact copy of the U.S., the Mexican legal system into an exact copy of the U.S. legal system. And I think, you know, that's obviously problematic for a lot of reasons.
Well, we've been speaking with Don Paley, who's an independent journalist out of Vancouver, B.C., also works out of Mexico. Thank you so much for this conversation. Very enlightening.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Bruce. It was wonderful.
To read more by Don Paley or hear some of her audio reports, check out her website at dawnpaley.ca. That's dawnpaley.ca. Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF.net out of Santa Rosa, California. The Final Straw is brought to you by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm features organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found online at www.firestormcafe.com.